Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, December 9th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin-Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight, we have money and markets. The questions will be in our precious metals market report with Franklin Sanders of The Money Changer, who I assure you has had a very busy week. And let's go to the movies, a review of Tony Scott's new thriller, Unstoppable. Our theme for tonight is planetary musical chairs. It probably deserves a subtitle of The Scramble for Tangibles. What we're watching, it's happening everywhere, it's all over the planet, is reconciliation with paper, with real things, whether it's the different bickerings in the sovereign bond market in Europe and the issues over financing the deficit and political consensus over tax changes here in the United States, or the success of the Chinese bond issues in Chinese yuan. We're just watching that reconciliation of paper with real things. And as we watch that, we see the faction fighting accelerating and the frustration in the grassroots and the anger growing. A great example of factionalism, as we talked about last time, but now it's happened. Nigeria files charges against Cheney in the Halliburton bribery scheme. Perfect example. An example of grassroots frustration reported today. Students protesting over tuition hikes in England attacked Prince Charles's car, breaking the bulletproof glass. Pictures up on Zero Hedge. An example of the meanness involved. I got a call from a subscriber today, a healthcare practitioner she knows well and trusts, warned us she'd been forced to go through the scanners at LAX. No search option, and couldn't turn back. As a result, she got very sick. So, warning, be careful. Any more reports you get, in fact, on that kind of situation in the airports, I'd love to hear about it. Money and markets, the crescendos of the factions fighting, including through WikiLeaks, finally stabilized with a new round of agreements. Agreement in Ireland, we saw the Irish budget, the austerity budget passed. Probably the most important agreement was between the White House and the Republican leadership regarding the extension of the Bush tax cuts as well as unemployment benefits, with a decision to finance it all with additional borrowings. We used to have a concept called PAYGO that said if you proposed a change in whether it was tax law or spending, that you had to come up with a revenue raise to match the expenditures that you were envisioning and whatever you were passing. They blew by it. The mechanism used was to engineer a decision to operate the government on a continuing resolution. Out comes an email right after that from the Campaign for Liberty in Tennessee. What that effectively means is that the Republicans have agreed with the administration to fund the back door, to fund through the back door the health care bill, which is a huge political victory for the administration and the pro-centralization team. That means the Republicans gave away the whole store to get the Bush tax cuts. It's pretty dramatic and not clearly visible from the coverage. The Democrats have still not agreed, so the deal still has plenty of obstacles to navigate. Meantime, it looks like the problems on the revenue raising on the food safety bill have been overcome by integrating a piece of it into a veterans appropriation bill. Let's see if that clears as well. What both of these deals ultimately mean is that Washington has taken a giant step forward in the service of centralization, radically tightening central control of healthcare and food. And these are two critical areas to control before the bad news on retirement benefits gets delivered in full. It's critical also to understand what was not in the deal. There was no provision for Build American Bonds. Build American Bonds are not a particular favorite of mine. I think it's a hugely wasteful way of supporting state and local government and municipal markets. But the reality is, it could have a hard impact on the municipal markets, which are reeling for a variety of reasons. Continued deficit problems. Schwarzenegger is now talking about $9 billion more cuts in California. But what we also have is inflation fears hitting the municipal bond market hard, and all continual centralization efforts continue to weaken state and local government hands. So, so real pressure on the municipal bond market, which could get very bad over the next year. Also, no forgiveness on the $600 reporting provision that small business provided W-2 for any $600 or more payment made out. The theory is that they couldn't come up with a revenue offset in time, which is so ridiculous if you just realize that they've agreed to spend $900 billion to extend the Bush tax cuts. Now, if you look at it, the $600 W-2 provision is something that serves or letting it stay is something that serves centralization. So across the board, we're seeing the same thing again and again, which is if it supports centralization, it's happening. If it doesn't support centralization, it's not happening. And that's really where the lines are getting drawn. Now, of course, the story that keeps commanding the headlines is WikiLeaks. I had a subscriber ask me if I thought that Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, was getting used. I wrote back as follows. I think Assange is brilliant and his intentions are for real. However, there are three states in this world, dead, insider, and used. We're trying to create a fourth one called outsider. It's hard to do. I was very reminded of the time when George W. Bush was governor of Texas, and the CIA and a variety of people were angling him to position him to run for president. And he made a speech on education, and someone I know who's very senior at the time in strategic planning at the CIA wrote me an email saying, "Don't you think this is brilliant?" and sending me a copy of the speech. And I wrote back and I said, "No, I think it's complete idiocy." And they wrote back and said, "Well, if you were in their shoes and you wanted to promote education, what would you say?" So I wrote something back. And then 2 weeks later, there was a copy of a new speech by Bush in the paper, and sure enough, my entire paragraph was in it. Is that you laughing, Franklin?
Yes. That's me chuckling.
And, you know, and so that's what I mean by, you know, you think you're an outsider, but you're not. You're being used because I didn't get paid for it. Anyway, so brilliant or no, unfortunately, the team at WikiLeaks joins us all in the category of to be used. One of the things I think was, because, and normally situations like this, when factions leak and fight with each other through something like WikiLeaks, you know, it's always a multivariate equation. There are multiple goals. But one of my theories has been, right before this latest round of leaks started, Hillary Clinton's name was circulating to replace Gates at Defense. And I said to a friend of mine who's recently retired from the military and but still in the defense world, "This is never going to happen. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are never going to let Hillary Clinton be Secretary of Defense." And sure enough, out comes a whole round of WikiLeaks. The person whose political capital gets harmed the worst is Clinton. The lead headline at the time that Julian does the interview at Time Magazine is that Clinton should resign. My guess is that her candidacy for DOD was serious. Now it's next. So the bottom line is the Joint Chiefs owe the CIA a very big one. Alex Jones is very concerned that WikiLeaks will be used to justify further control of the Internet. Those plans are coming one way or another. One thing I will say is I think all transparency is good. And while the WikiLeaks attention and conversation is overshadowed, the more horrible developments in the food and tax area, I think it's bringing up a lot of good points, because ultimately, if there is one thing that can shift everything, it's transparency. Now, Julian is now under arrest. If you look at the details of the case against him, he's being arrested for having consensual sex with adult women. And the exact issue is whether or not he used a condom. Apparently, in Sweden, if you don't use a condom, you can go to jail for 2 years. If you can imagine that, with consensual sex. The question from one subscriber: is this a honey trap? Probably. A honey trap is when you set somebody up for a charge on sex. you look at the sort of pictures of Assange going off to prison, and it reminds me of the, you know, of walking into church and seeing again and again the statue of Jesus bleeding on the cross. The subliminal message to lots of kids is, if you mess with our money, this is what happens to you. And so the whole process is very big money for media. A lot of factions have fought through them. At the same time, you know, my attitude is all transparency is good, so my prayers continue to be with them. I'm putting up the information on how how to donate to them now that the Swiss postal system has thrown them out, as has PayPal and Amazon. Now, if you think WikiLeaks had a bad week, the Fed probably had a worse one. Bernanke showed up on 60 Minutes, looked pretty shaky. You wonder what, you know, what had happened for the 2 days before that. He attributed the income differential in America to disparity in education. Now, I must tell you that if the fundamental disparity in America is between cost of capital and who has to pay for their mistakes. So let's go back. If Goldman Sachs can borrow at 0% and Franklin and I have to pay 30% for our equity capital, and Goldman Sachs can get bailed out every time they have a problem and we have to muddle through, then it doesn't take long to figure out that it's not to their advantage that they went to Harvard and I only went to Wharton. Where did you go to college, Franklin?
I just went to the School of Hard Knocks.
You met Susan in college, so I know.
I went to what used to be Southwestern at Memphis. It's called Rhodes College now.
Okay, so but I would dare say that with a differential in cost of capital between 0% plus bailouts and the rest of us paying anywhere from 8 to 30%, that the problem is not disparity in education. But it truly was not his Ben's finest hour. We're left with the impression that he truly does not understand the economy, or else he would have come up with a better spin. One of the things that happened is, thanks to the effort, among others, of Bernie Sanders, disclosure on the Fed side of the bailouts has now proved my point that trillions during the bailouts went to foreign institutions. And I continue to believe that, and this only corroborates it, that Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize because of bailing out the European interest from fraudulent U.S. paper. He probably did indeed stop a war. Globally, everyone is struggling with inflation, whether they are having or whether they're debasing their currency themselves or picking it up from the U.S. excuse me, and others who are. Amazingly, earlier this week, the Swiss franc, U.S. dollar, Australian dollar, and Canadian dollar moved almost into a perfect parity. It was amazing to behold, and it's a reminder just how much of the U.S. dollar has slid. One of the few currencies that has protected holders and purchasing power in the slow burn continues to be precious metals. Expect that to continue for some time. One way or another, gold and silver are going to be part of the new global currency systems. I think the chances of gold and silver being essential for maintaining liquidity locally are growing significantly, and that's why Franklin and I are going to be discussing some of the things we're talking about tonight. Our hero this week, Donald Bartlett and James B. Steele, investigative reporter team. They used to be at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now they write for specials for Vanity Fair. They've done a new piece called Deadly Medicine that explores the outsourcing of drug testing abroad. Overseas drug testing has skyrocketed from 271 trials in 1990 to 6,485 in 2008, and some of the things going on are really blood-curdling. Not that the pharmaceutical industry corruption will surprise you, but this really is a new and meaner version. And I will tell you that the kind of investigative reporter that that Don and James Steele do is really an extraordinary thing to dig in and put it together and analyze in the way that they do. And they're two of the top investigative reporters in the country and the world. Okay, well, I'm going to defer the Ask Catherine questions to the precious metal segment. So, Franklin,
yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You've had quite a week.
That's right. It's a little bit like being the test pilot in a torture chamber, to tell you the truth. It was
a little bit strange. Catch us up on the market. What's happened?
Well, on the 6th, you got new highs in gold and silver, and we hit that 47.5 ratio. But they also collapsed the same day, so there was not a lot of time to get the trades off. But I've been working, 4 years to set up for this trade. And then what's happened is that in the last, since July, silver and gold have both been rising very, very sharply. And that always brings a lot of scrap metal, especially silver, onto the market, because people see these higher prices and they want to sell. When you're talking about prices go from $17 to $27, you're going to call out a huge amount of scrap. I've had customers who, over my dead body and against my advice, still insist on selling and the reason I don't want them to is because, of course, we're just seeing the beginning of this. Yes,
I
understand silver's risen 7.5 times from its $4 low, but the last time, in the last bull market, it rose 35 times.
Right.
So, this is just a market that's going up. That's all it is. It's just a bull market. But what happened was he called out all that scrap, and the refineries have gotten backed up. So now the refineries are backed up for 2.5 months. That means that when you take metal to the refinery to be refined, like, for instance, 90% silver coin, it takes them 2.5 months to process it. And you have to finance that in the meantime. And, it's just the physical market is just a small market. And I couldn't find anybody to buy the bags in the volume that I had them to sell in. And so we didn't get to do any of the trades for the 90% coin. We did trades for the people who had IRAs, who had bullion in the IRAs. We did those, and it hasn't come back yet. Now, I understand, and I have about 8 people writing me every day telling me that, don't you read the Internet? Don't you know that J.P. Morgan is short a zillion ounces of silver, and silver is going to go to $600 by the end of the week? And the only thing I can say to that is that I said it in my commentary tonight, the last 4 words that you hear before you lose vast amounts of money is, it's different this time. and that is exactly what these people are telling me. It's different this time. Well, they think that silver is going to keep on rising, blow past gold, and never come back. And there is some kind of chance that it might go down to 47, might go through 47.5 and go on down to 41 even. That's certainly a possibility, but it's not the greatest likelihood. And one of the things that I've had to learn in my life, because I am a plunger, I admit it, I'm the guy that draws to an inside straight, or used to be anyway. And one of the things that I've tried to teach myself is don't take the slightest chance. Always play the main chance.
Right.
And the main chance is that we're going to, that the ratio will go down here, and then it will bounce back up, as it always does, to somewhere around or over 57.5.
Right.
And, you just have to control your greed and your fear.
Right.
I understand. I mean, I'm just as subject to it as anybody else is, but you just have to. You have to realize that when a market is going up, and you know this as well as I do, Catherine, when a bull market is going on, my goodness, you can't hear anything but stories about how it's not only going to continue, but it's going to speed up. I mean, think about that. We just came through, 10 years of the housing bubble.
Right.
And you remember all the stories about people that got rich overnight in real estate, how I made $1 million in real estate, and so forth and so on. Well, where are they now?
Right.
They didn't get out.
Right.
And this is another thing that this week really, really underscored to me. We have to have a plan for getting out of the market. We have to have a plan for what we're going to do when the peak is approaching.
Right.
And it's not necessary that you pick the very peak. It's simply enough that you read the signs that say, look, it's coming. It's coming soon, and it's time to get out of the market. Because once that peak hits, you know as well as I do, it just falls off so rapidly, and it doesn't come back for 20 years.
Well, it's funny. So, I was just telling my attorney this story. I remember I was sitting in a mansion in Washington, and I made a decision that I had a house full of antiques and artwork and, you know, just incredible amounts of stuff. And when I decided I was going to fight, I said, okay, that's it. I'm selling everything. I'm selling the mansion. I'm selling the antiques. I'm selling the artwork. And we decided to do it over eBay. And at one point, somebody turned to me as we're marking all these things and selling them off on eBay. Don't you feel terrible? I said, no, we're the lucky ones. Everybody in America is going to have to do this, but we get to do it while they're in a bubble. They're going to have to do it when everybody's hurrying and trying to sell it through eBay.
And everybody else is lined up along the side of the road trying to sell their watch.
Right. So I'd rather go first.
Yeah, you're pointing out something, though, that also was pressed on my mind this week. And that is, there's a certain sense in which, as we're investing in silver and gold, we're kind of playing the game of the insiders. That is, we're trying to fade what they're doing. We're trying to hedge what they're doing. And that's not the permanent way out of this. That may be a tool to help us get to the permanent exit, but the permanent way out is for us to build an economy that works.
Right.
And the way we're going to have to do that is to invest in our neighbors. And I confess, you know, I'm no better than anybody else at figuring out exactly how these things are going to be done. But we're just going to have to grab a root and growl. That's all I know to do. But
right.
Just simply trying to play a market and save your little retirement income.
It's not enough.
It's not enough. It really isn't. It's just like people who work to make money. I mean, if you work to make money, I feel sorry for you, because that's an easy thing to do. You know, prostitutes do that, and they do real well at it. But it's not a satisfying way to live. So anyway,
There's one quick question I have on the gold trading, the gold silver ratio.
Mm-hmm.
One I can answer, one I can't. Let me ask you the first that I can't answer. How do I trade the ratio in Canada? Use eBay, GateWest, LTD will not do it.
GateWest is a coin dealer, and I've sent people to them. Canada is another thing, but let me make a suggestion. One easy way to do the ratio trade is to use gold money. Gold money offers silver, so you buy silver through gold money. And when the time comes, you just put in a swap order, an exchange order, and swap it. And you won't get the exact price because they work on the, as far as I can tell, they work on the fix. So,
right.
And you know what the fix is, a method used by those large dealers in London to fill all their orders at a kind of agreed on price. But what it does is for them, it removes all the risk. And, you know, people may think, well, that's a fixed market. Well, it's an orderly market. And it's, you know, it's a way that it's a published price, so everybody knows what you're getting. Anyway, they do that. And I think that, you know, that's an easy, good way to do it. That'll work for a Canadian or for anybody in the world. Other than that, you know, you can play it through the futures exchange, but that's a little harder to do. And
right.
You know.
Well, it's funny you said that, because the other question was gold money will let me swap, but I have to do it in real time, can't preset the transaction by ratio. What I found with gold money, because we worked through it with a group of people this week and last on gold money, is there is a timing issue because of how because of the fix.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, sell at 1 minute, but you buy at a different time. It doesn't have to be too long, but there is a risk of the spread widening. So,
well, there is, but the thing is, so what? So, you know, you want to trade at 47.5 and you get 48.5. So what?
Right. If I wanted to trade, I wouldn't let that stop me.
No.
The other thing I found was, for a variety of reasons, it made a lot of sense for people who are swapping out of silver at gold money to go into coin. So, in other words, to literally move from gold money into physical.
And to
take the swap opportunity to do that.
Well, were they taking delivery from gold money or?
No. In that case, they were selling and then buying other, but they could take delivery. The problem is you'd have to take delivery and,
Well, I mean, you can take delivery, but I think they've got 100 gram bars or something like that, that if you live in the United States, unless you're an Indian, you just don't, nobody
right.
invests in.
Right.
The other thing is there's some dealers, I mean, we do it where you can buy gold that way and pay us that way, but not many people do that.
Right.
But that would be another way to do it.
Now, one of the things I had asked you to be ready to talk a little bit about is we have certainly felt the, I dare say this is going to be another December when gold hits a high for the year.
Uh-huh.
And so the question, of course, is as we move through December, what have the historical trading patterns been in the first quarter? If the fourth quarter is the high, what does the first quarter look like? Over the last decade, what does that mean about what we might expect in the first quarter in 2011?
Well, one of the things that I have to say is you sort of have to throw away the seasonal chart. The seasonal chart is based on averages, and it gives you some idea of how the year will play out, but it's a very, very general idea. What I found was that there have been three major peaks in the last 10 years, and they hit in February, March, and May. Now, it would be unusual, not just out of this world, but it would be a little unusual to have a peak in December. So that sort of makes me lean to think that we're going to see a peak in January, which would certainly be possible because we're overdue for one. But what folks have to realize is that when we get to the peak of this, the intermediate peak of this move, and by intermediate I mean more than short term, more than 12 months, when we get to the peak of this intermediate move, there's going to be a correction that will last roughly 6 months to a year. And so you have to be expecting that. So if you get a peak in December or in January, then you're going to get a February, a March, and an April at least that are down months. But whenever that peak falls, within 3 to 4 months, you're going to get the price extreme, the price low, as a reaction from that high. And so what that means is that you ought to be planning on buying everything you could buy at that point.
So February, March, April?
Well, no, it won't be. If you get the peak in December, it will be, March, let's say, mid-February or March before you get that reaction low. I mean, you just the maximum for the reaction low would be about 15 weeks. And 15 weeks.
And what, if you get that kind of consolidation, Franklin, what percentage are we talking down?
Let me just go back and correct. There is no if. Every market goes up and down, so there will be a correction.
Mm-hmm.
And the percentage you're looking at, I'd say, on gold is 30%. It might not be that much. Now, it might be 25, it might be 20, but I'd say you have to reckon with about 30%. And for silver, about 50%. So,
50%, that's big.
50% of the previous move up, not 50% of the top price.
Okay.
So, in other words, we started about $14.50, and let's say that we went to 30. So that would be $15.50, and half of 15.5 is 725, and 725 from 30 is 22.75, so $23. It comes back to $23, maybe. something like that. But it might not be that strong. But generally, the silver reaction is always much stronger because silver is more volatile on the downside as well as the upside. So you get that bigger kick going up, but you also get a bigger kick in the head going down. And it's just something, you know, you have to get used to. But that these numbers are based on what we've seen before in the markets, and I wouldn't push against them. They're the main chance, all right? They're the main chance. So, and it, you know, it might be crazy. You might get this run might extend all the way out to March. If it does, good gracious, I don't know where it'll go. I mean, if it extends to March, it'll go through $1,600. Which had been one of my technical targets, it'll go through $1,600 and go to, who knows? I mean, there's no way of telling.
Right.
But you know, time and price go together. And the longer you have to run, the higher the price is going to go. So.
Well, one of the things I'm struck by is I look now at the subscribers I know and the people in my life I know who have been using precious metals as a form of currency and as an investment for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. and the extent to which they've protected themselves in ways that others who haven't.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary the difference it has made in their lives and in their personal confidence and sense of safety. I mean, not only has it had a big impact financially, but it's really had a big impact on their view of the world. In other words, we can understand our world. We can take actions to protect ourselves. We can navigate the situation. And it's pretty gratifying. And that's why I wanted to talk with you about the gold and silver clause contracts. Because when you sit down and you say, I think the chances that we could have to use our gold and silver to provide liquidity,
uh-huh.
and to transact are really rising. And I'm seeing in my life, Franklin, more and more people realizing, I want to buy coins that I could use if I needed to. And I want to understand how to transact. That's, in fact, we're responding to a subscriber who said, I want to do I'm building a house and I want to do my construction contract in gold and silver. How do I do that? And so, but I wanted to just read something that Julian Assange had said in his interview in Time, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, and talk about why I think it's so relevant to the conversation that we're having now. He said, and this was in the Skype interview he gave to Time magazine, and if you want to read it, it's up on the blog. Aspects of the Chinese government appear to be terrified of free speech. And while one might say that means something awful is happening in the country, I actually think it's a very optimistic sign because it means that speech can still cause reform and that the power structure is still inherently political as opposed to fiscal. So journalism and writing are capable of achieving change, and that is why Chinese authorities are so scared of it. Whereas in the United States, to a large degree, and in other Western countries, the basic elements of society have been so heavily fiscalized through contractual obligations that political change doesn't seem to result in economic change, which in other words means that political change doesn't result in change. Now, if you listen to what he's saying the same thing that you and I have been talking about the dependency of household and local economies on government subsidies and all sorts of rules and regulations and enforcement.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, when you've got half the people who make their living, who earn their income from government, then you've got an economy that's not just crippled, but it's shrunk. You know, I mean, 40% of the people are doing the work, and the other 60% are living off of those people. And I don't mean that in the usual, you know, you're a bunch of freeloading bums way that a lot of conservatives use it. But what I mean is they don't know how to make a living.
Right.
They don't know how to contribute to the economy as free agents. And I think one of the things that has heartened and inspirited these people you're talking about who've learned to deal in gold and silver is just the exhilarating experience of doing business with somebody, you give him your word, he gives you your word, and you swap whatever things you've got. He does something for you, or you do something for him, and then he pays you in something real. And it's just an exhilarating experience of freedom, and
right.
And it's great, you know.
And the people who have their own businesses,
mm-hmm.
you know, many of them are working harder, but they're doing much better than people who are working as employees for the most part.
Right, and they enjoy what they're doing.
Right,
and so they can put all of their creative power to work in that business. Let me say something about using gold and silver now as money, though. One of the first problems that you have to overcome is that most Americans do not think in terms of value. They think in terms of numbers. They think numbers, not value. So what that means is that the common run of folks, although they'll admit, well, yeah, I'm sure inflation hurts, they think that $100,000 in 2000 is equal to $100,000 in 2010. And they don't realize that their $100,000 in 2010 will buy maybe $80,000 worth of stuff that it would have bought, you know, what $80,000 would have bought in 2000. So
right.
You have to learn to look at the value and the purchasing power and not the numbers. The numbers don't count. Not the number of dollars, because that is a measure that, number one, is always diminishing, and so number two is no standard of value. You can't use it as a measure. It's like having a yardstick made out of rubber, the kind of stretchy rubber, you know, that goes back and becomes smaller. You stretch it out and you measure with it, and then you come back and it shrunk up again, and so you don't know what a yard is or a foot or an inch or anything else.
Well, it's, you know, there's that problem, and there's another one which we talked about when we did the audio seminar, Building Real Wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And I should just mention for everybody listening, the Building Real Wealth audio seminar is in your archive at your subscriber card. And it's very hard for most people who haven't operated their own business and built financial equity in their own business to see equity. I was really struck when I moved to Hardeman County, and the county had just done a series of privatization deals on prisons.
Uh-huh.
And basically they assumed the contracts, they financed it with bonds, they took a whole bunch of the liability. Right after they did the deal, the former chairman of the Republican Party of Tennessee walked away. He sold his stocks options for $17 million because they created hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars of financial equity and just gave it away. And if you look at how much financial equity they could have cut the county in for, it was enough to pay off all our bonds and put up serious money behind the school system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but that's because no one saw the equity. Equity is, you know, and that's sort of the way that government money and games are used to rig that equity. You know, our local equity is getting drained and drained and drained, and that process is invisible, just as the currency debasement is.
Well, it's invisible to people who are not trained to look for it.
Right.
You know, it's not invisible if you know to look for it.
Right.
And
so part of getting interested in circulating equity locally or in using gold and silver locally, and I happen to think that those two are like two sides of a coin.
Mm-hmm.
You can't solve the equity problem without solving the currency problem, and you can't solve the currency problem without seeing the equity opportunity.
I couldn't agree more. That's the reason why I keep harping on this idea of starting a local gold and silver circulation, because once that starts, you're independent. Your local economy can become independent of the dollar, which means it's independent of the whole national economy.
Well,
and we've stopped being economic units in a government cog, and we've gone back to being human beings living in community with each other and doing business with each other.
Right, and the political food fight is really, you not only protect yourself from debasement, but you protect yourself from digital, you know, basically you're creating privacy, because right now, as long as we're digital, our privacy is being invaded by a whole variety of systems that we're not even aware of.
Everything you do every charge you make, every place you go, you leave a track with those charge cards. That's one of the chief reasons to get yourself, $500 a week and spend pictures of dead presidents instead of that charge card. And by the way, we got a dramatic example of this in the last few days. All those hackers who wanted to strike back for Assange because Amazon, PayPal, and I think Visa and
Swiss,
MasterCard.
PayPal cut him, Amazon cut him, and the Swiss postal system cut him.
Right. Well, the Visa and MasterCard did too. And of course, and I know they got a call from somebody in a high place that said, we'd really take it as a favor if you would cut this guy off. And so what these people did was these hackers attacked the website and actually took down MasterCard's website for a while. Well, the point I'm trying to make is this. Why do we give power to these centralized payment agencies like PayPal or MasterCard? And do you realize what the MasterCard and Visa have a 100% charge on the money they create? Think
right.
about it. They create the money out of nowhere, and you pay them for using it. They not only have the 100% seniorage by creating the money out of thin air, then you have to pay them 27% a month or 18% or whatever it is to use it.
Right.
It's absolutely insane. And the way to get out of that, of course, is to live within your means, live on cash, and stop using the credit cards. But we're never going to get to the subject if I don't cut this short. I'm sorry. Every time, this is my hot button, and so every time.
Well, I asked you, how are we going to do this? Gold and silver clothes.
Listen, it's the simplest thing in the world. People don't understand it. They don't understand that they forge their own chains.
Not just people. I don't understand it.
Okay.
I'm trying.
We all forge our own chains because everyone has a common law and a constitutional and a statutory right to gold and silver money.
Right.
Only instead of using that public money, you use private money, that is money created by the corporations, by the Federal Reserve, because it's easier. And you can go now, you can go to Title 31 in the United States Code, and you can flip through there, and you will be surprised to find that gold and silver coin are legal tender in the United States. And admittedly, there's confusion because there are several different standards that have been created over the years, especially after the issuance of the American Eagle coins beginning in 1996. So, but basically, here's what you do. A contract, you remember that in 1934, they outlawed gold clause contracts as, quote, against public policy. But the truth is, we're always free to contract for anything that's not a crime. In other words, I can't make a contract with you to go kill somebody for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can certainly contract if if I want to buy goats from you, and I need and you need lumber, and I've got lumber, we can make a contract that says I'm going to deliver to you 9,000 board feet of lumber, and you're going to deliver to me 55 goats.
Mm-hmm.
And we're free to do that. And a gold and silver clause contract is really not any different in concept than that. The thing is that you have to, when you write the contract, if it's something like, let's say, building a house, and let's say you're building a house that would be worth 100 ounces of gold, all right, which is today would be about $140,000. You want a contract with the person who's building it so that he doesn't go over the budget that you've got and so forth. And what you have to do is to put in there language that says, this is what we're contracting for, this many dollars. And the dollars are of this standard of coin. That is the standard of 1985 of the gold coins or the 1 ounce silver coin.
Do you have to use a U.S. minted coin for it to be a legal contract under U.S. law?
Not for it to be a legal contract, but for it to be a legal tender contract, it does have to be.
Okay.
Here's the difference in the legal tender contract. There was a case called Thompson versus Butler after the war between the states. And basically, Butler, who was a repulsive political general and crook from Massachusetts, had a case where the amount at value was less than $5,000, which was at the time the jurisdictional limit of the court. And he went in and he argued, no, you ought to hear my case in federal court because the contract is for gold and the gold is worth more on the open market than 5,000 paper dollars. And what the court said was, look, a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. We didn't make the dollars. Congress made the dollars. And it doesn't make a hoot's bit of difference what their value is in the market. As far as the law is concerned, they're all dollars.
Now, so what that means is their value is the face value.
Right. Their value, as far as the law is concerned, is the face value. So theoretically, what that means, I know that most of your listeners have already raced ahead to this conclusion. What that means is I could require people to pay me in gold dollars according to the standard of 1986, all right? That is, the 1 ounce gold equals $50. And I could make the provision that they have to pay me in that. And then if I were a person who filed income tax returns, I'd add up all those numbers of dollars that I'd received during the year, and I would pay taxes on those. And when I got ready to send them the payment, I'd send it to them in paper dollars. Because they're all dollars.
Now, hasn't that been adjudicated, though? Isn't that?
No.
No?
Only Thompson versus Butler. And the reason it hasn't been adjudicated, I believe, is because the IRS knows that and the government knows they'd lose. Because it's standing law. It's existing
right.
law. And that's what the Supreme Court said in 1870. That's what the law is. Now, of course, they're going to try to intimidate you out of doing it. I mean, of course, they're going to tell you, oh, no, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. But that's their interpretation. My interpretation is the Supreme Court is right. I'm not going to argue against
right.
the Supreme Court. But again, I'm a plunger, okay? Let's forget that part of it. Let's just say I don't care about the tax part of it. What I care about is I want to be paid in something that has value, and not only has value but maintains its value and even grows in value. So I make a gold clause contract, or you can make a silver clause contract. You can, any of these things are legal tender. Let me tell you how many standards there are. First of all, they're silver dollars. That's a standard that was set in 1792 as the basic coin of the United States, the so-called coin of the realm, and that has never been changed. And that's a dollar of about 3/4 of an ounce of silver. And then there's a standard of the 90% silver coin. It has about 50 ounces less of silver to the $1,000, and that's the standard of 1854 or 1857, I can't remember which, but and then you roll along, and then the gold coins, of course, from the standard of 1837, which is a $20 gold piece worth that contains 0.9675 ounces of gold. That's about $20 to the ounce. And then there's the standard of 1985 and 86, when the gold coins, the American Eagle gold coin bill was passed, and the Silver Liberty gold coin bill, which everybody calls an American Eagle. So you can write a contract in any of those forms or in mixed forms.
Right.
And it's perfectly legal. There's nothing wrong with that. And it was specifically authorized in 1974 when those provisions of the gold, the Act of 1934 that prohibited gold ownership were overthrown. That at the end of 1974, those were repealed.
Right.
And that was the point at which it became possible to own gold again in the United States, supposedly.
Now, one of the subscribers just posted, they can post questions live, just posted a very interesting question, and let me just read it to you. Why buy a house with silver stipulations when you can pay with devalued dollars? If you have a fixed mortgage and have money left to buy metals, then do it that way.
Well, that's doing things from a different standpoint. You're trying to accomplish a different thing. You borrow the dollars and you pay back. You're planning on paying back cheaper dollars, right?
I'm assuming that's what he means.
That raises the interesting question: is it possible to cheat a bank? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But I don't think it's a good thing to plan to do that way. If you could, but if you want to build a house and your builder wants to be paid in gold, you just simply write up the contract and do it. I mean, it's just,
well,
it's just
here's the interesting thing that I would say, and I go back to what I call total economic return.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a whole ecosystem and you take 100,000 people in a county,
mm-hmm.
and they start paying each other in currencies that don't get debased,
mm-hmm.
then what happens is they start incrementally increasing each other's wealth a lot. In other words, if my neighbors are wealthy, I've got a better chance of getting wealthier.
Right.
And right. and there's a point at which, you know, yeah, I mean, I think sometimes you can drain a bank, but actually it's not a bank since they're securitizing the mortgage into our pension funds.
Right.
So we're draining ourselves, ultimately, is how that works. And I think we need a way of envisioning building an economy. Right now we all assume I'm gonna win by your losing. And we've got to start building an economy where I'm winning by helping you win. And
right.
you win by helping me win. Now, that's a very deep cultural change from where we are. Because, you know, it's not just the top guys who've learned to be a parasite. It's a far wider cultural phenomenon.
Well, everybody has an interest in the continuation of the inflation.
Right.
Anybody who owns a house has an interest in the continuation of the inflation. That's the way it's been set up. But you're right. It, you know, we're parasitizing one of the one. Every one of us is parasitizing the other. And here's the advantage of using a gold silver contract. Let's say I go to this builder, and I say to the builder, you know, I'd be willing to pay you in gold, but I'm not going to pay you the same thing that I would pay you if you were building if I were paying you dollars. I want to pay you less because the gold is gaining value over time, and so I have to have another price if I'm going to pay you in gold. And if the builder has any sense, he knows that it's in his self-interest, it's in his own interest to pay, to be paid in gold, and so he's going to accept a slightly lower price.
Right.
Everybody wins. I get my house for a lower price. He gets paid in better money.
Right.
So
we're both not dealing with that debasement. We're
right.
both avoiding that.
We're both taking ourselves out of that situation. So we have an exchange where we're not subject to the debasement. We're not subject to the inflation, and so we both win by that deal.
Now, Edwin Vieira has a pamphlet that you kindly arranged for me to get. It's called Gold Clauses and Silver Clauses in Financial Transactions, a Practical Study Concerning Their Origin and Use. Now, he doesn't have an online store sort of way of getting this. Do you know how, if a subscriber was interested in buying a copy, do you know how we could get one?
You know, I asked him about that, and he sent me a copy of it in response. And he's a wonderful fellow, but he's not the best marketer in the world. He's a great researcher and a great writer, but marketing, no, he's not as good on that. I honestly don't know, but I can go after. You know, he said he wanted to rewrite it still. I asked him why he didn't have the standard of, you know, the subsidiary silver coin standard in there, and so I think he's going to go back and add those things to it. But why don't we just I'll just keep asking him, and when I find out, then we'll...
Well, if you'll get on it, I would appreciate it. One thing I will point out, it's worked to my advantage because I have a copy of Pieces of Eight, his Monetary History of the United
uh-huh.
States,
uh-huh.
which is two volumes. I bought it when it first came out. And David Lichty came to Hickory Valley. He moved to Hickory Valley to be an intern at Solari on the understanding if he came... He could, for the time he was in Hickory Valley, possess and use my Pieces of Eight. That's how dear it was. And
By the way, did you know he's having that reprinted?
Yep, and I put that up on the blog. It's
yeah.
If you just do a search for Edwin Vieira on the blog, you'll come. Go, the Gold Money Foundation is paying for it to be printed, and then he's then selling what they what they've printed, and so. You can get that again, and I have to tell to everyone on this call, it's one of the most phenomenal pieces of research I've ever seen. It's a complete monetary history of the United States, and it's absolutely amazing.
Oh, it's maniac. It's got 6,000 footnotes. I asked him, the first time I saw it, I said, 6,000 footnotes? Isn't that footnotes to excess? But
yeah.
He spent years, absolutely years, working it up, and there is nothing he has missed. So it is the premiere. It is. There's nothing even close to that.
It is the Cadillac history. On monetary history.
Oh, yeah. And it's not only that, but he makes it understandable too.
Right.
And but if you have a copy of that little booklet of his, then it's pretty easy to make up a gold clause contract of your own. And of course you can take it to a lawyer and have a lawyer do it, but it's not that big
a
deal.
Yeah, no, you can do it yourself.
But the thing is that we have to, somebody has to take the first step, Catherine. Somebody
right.
has to do it. And I know people, we do business with people where they say, look, I want to be paid in gold. I don't want anything else. I want my employer to do that. So I'm going to have my employer send you money and you send me the gold. And we do that.
Yep.
So they're not receiving.
It's starting. It's slow at first, but we're moving from zero to one. I can feel it and see it in all sorts of situations. Two very quick questions, okay? I just need you to do 30 seconds on each one. My son thinks silver and gold are in a bubble. He's previously been able to identify most of the big market bubbles. I told him because it had been fraudulently controlled and manipulators might be running out of ammunition, it might explode upward. Who's right?
You are.
Well, I would say there's a difference between a long-term bull market and a bubble. And there's
right.
no doubt, that I think we're in a long-term bull market, but there are short-term moments, and I think we're in one right now that certainly, within that long-term bull market, you get these bubble ups.
Right.
And that's when you get corrections back. So I would say there's a difference between a long-term bull market. And it's very hard for people to understand how this could be a long-term bull market without really looking under the rug to see what's going on in the real economy, which is a very frightening experience.
Well, could I draw a distinction in bull markets?
Sure.
Between bubbles and what we're seeing now. Bubbles are almost always financed by government money or by bank money creation or a combination of those two.
Right.
I mean, think about the stock market bubble that ran in the 1990s. Clearly, that was Greenspan turning on the spout and pouring money. Then you had, the real estate bubble, which was the same thing, plus all the government subsidies to housing and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the whole mortgage setup. But the silver and gold are rising without any government money. In fact, they're rising against a decades-long
government selling out cheap.
Government price suppression. And that's one of the things that made them do so well made both metals do so well in the 1980s was that they were bouncing back from a price suppression that had lasted for 40 or 50 years.
Right.
So there is a difference between a bubble and a bull market, and you just have to be able to see it.
Yep. Well, I'm not going to ask you the other question because I got 2 minutes to describe Unstoppable.
Uh-oh.
Which, Franklin, if you think you had a tough week, you should see what happens to Denzel Washington in Unstoppable. Unstoppable is is directed by Tony Scott. Tony Scott is the director of Enemy of the State, Crimson Tide, a lot of my favorite movies. You all know how much I love Enemy of the State. His brother, Ridley Scott, is another one of my great directors. He did Gladiator, Thelma and Louise, Alien. The two of them are just unbelievable. Unstoppable is the story. It's based on a real story, story of two train engineers in Pennsylvania in the movie. The true story was in Ohio. And Chris Pine and Denzel Washington are in the middle of corporate downsizing and all sorts of divide-and-conquer politics, young versus old, men versus women, black versus white. And in the middle of all of this, they turn it into real success in the face of real trouble. It's one of those stories where the pro-decentralization team wins and the corporate guys look terrible, and it makes you feel good and a happy ending. And you can argue that that's not reality, but you have to envision what it feels like to duplicate it in the real world. It's great entertainment. Denzel Washington, Chris Pine are train engineers on the road. A large train gets loose out of the yard and ends up in high throttle going 70, 80 miles an hour through populated areas without an engineer. It's a runaway train. And Tony Scott can make great action movies, and Denzel Washington is his usually amazing self. And there's a happy ending that reminds you that real productivity and excellence matter. They always have and they always will. So Unstoppable. If you're having a bad day and you want to see somebody who's having a worse day than you, you'll definitely see that. And not only that, see them survive it and come out on top because they never give up. So Unstoppable, it's if you like that genre, it's another goodie by Tony Scott. Coming up December 16th, Who Rules with Daniel Estulon. This was in response to your request. He's the author of The Bilderbergers and Shadow Masters, and has spent a lifetime as an investigative reporter trying to answer the question that my old friend, president of Sunship Building, used to ask, who's doing this? Who's really in control? January 7th is the year-end wrap-up. The Road Turns East was our sort of slogan for 2010, and that's what we're going to be describing, sort of how the road turned east. January 14th, we'll be back with Franklin for the Precious Metals Market Report and our outlook for 2011. Next week, we're sending out our annual holiday greeting. We've been working a long time on it. It's really beautiful, so stay tuned. You'll get that in our weekly update. If you're interested in giving the Solari Report as a Christmas gift, we'd love it. Just call the number on our website. It's 406-755-3548. Let me give that to you again. It's 406-755-3548. During business hours, Darlene and Jennifer would love to help you arrange a six-month or annual subscription for the person that you're giving it to. Meantime, thank you for subscribing, and thank you for your suggestions, your questions, and your support. We appreciate them and you. Please remember, until next week, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.